they're still able to put the fans through the ringer, even when you can spend £300 million building a team, build a club to have the single greatest manager that is in world football at the moment, but they can still have that moment where you think, they're not going to do this.
Especially over the next 2-3 years, it could be an era of dominance domestically, definitely. I think Europe's a different kettle of fish. It's just so difficult to win a Champions League. I think obviously we've got a very good chance.
We've always, as City fans, looked at United and said, you know, half of them come from down south, and laughed at them and not liked it. But actually, that is the direction that City are going, and that's the direction they want to go in.
Hello and welcome to Who Are You? A monthly podcast about the football clubs of Great Britain. Every month we travel to a different football club and find out about the issues affecting them. Every club has a story to tell, from those battling for trophies to those struggling to stay afloat. Over the course of this podcast, we will attempt to discover what really matters to fans, placing their stories in a broader footballing context. We'll go to any club at any level in the men's and women's games. Before we get started on this episode, a reminder that if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could spread the word through social media, telling a friend, or leaving a review on iTunes, as that stuff is vital in helping independent podcasts like this very one grow. If somehow you missed our incessant tweeting about the subject, you'll be glad to hear our news. We've just received silver in the Best Sports Podcast category at the British Podcast Awards, which, by the fact that the winning podcast was about fighting, makes this podcast you're listening to right now the best football podcast in the land. Needless to say, we're chuffed with this, and it's only made us want to make this podcast better. So thank you for supporting us this far. We hope you'll stick with us for whatever the future holds. In this episode, we go right to the very top of English football. This is Manchester City. You might know them from this moment.
Something that at that point I'd never really experienced as a football fan before, going to a game, obviously in the hope that we were going to win the league and do so over United.
I was commentating for the BBC, so I'm in a giddy moment as a commentator thinking, what do I say the moment City win the league?
At the time I was working on a cruise ship and I managed to watch the first half in my cabin. Zabaleta scored 1-0 up and then I go to work.
Then it's all square and you think, hang on, this is a bit City-esque. Then they go behind and you think, oh my God, once again, everybody's going to be laughing at City. Everybody's going to say, shot themselves in the foot on the biggest day.
Not supposed to have my phone with me while I'm working, but I did. I'd asked my brother to keep texting me updates. And every few minutes I glanced at my phone, the news was getting worse and worse and worse. And very helpfully, my brother was texting me snippets of commentary like, psychologically, we may never recover from this if we don't win it.
I was just going through my head, just thinking about going and seeing all my mates, you know, that evening and the next day, and just everything was just going through as if life was kind of flashing before your eyes.
I managed to finish work and I had 5 minutes to go and check on the TV, 88 minutes on the clock. Dzeko pops up.
This is just going to be even worse now because they're one goal away from winning it.
I had my head in my hands. I didn't even see Dzeko's goal.
Suddenly there's a chance. There's a glimmer of hope. We're way into injury time now. There's not enough time on the clock.
You know, City, we don't do things like this.
We don't seem to be chasing it. We're playing sideways passes. It just doesn't... It's almost as if they don't understand, that the guys on the pitch don't understand what this means to us, and we're going to miss it. We're going to lose out.
Bolton Wanderers that day were playing at Stoke. QPR obviously were in the relegation battle with them, and I suddenly see Mark Hughes celebrating, the QPR manager. The United game's finished and they've won 1-0.
Just totally typically City, isn't it? It's like that. It can go down to the last kick of the last game of the season. Everybody given up, hadn't they? We'd all given up. Nobody thought it was going to happen.
And then as the ball's moving through midfield from Nigel de Jong,
it's Balotelli. And for all his craziness, for all his madness, for all the why me and the fireworks in his bathroom, that for me is the moment I'll always remember Balotelli.
Nigel de Jong is playing it to Mario Balotelli.
And then the impossible happened.
There was a kind of deadly silence between Balotelli pass over towards Aguero and when he's actually kicking the ball, and the stadium is just quiet. And then there's that almost delayed reaction of the noise, and that gap, that quiet, that kind of pause in the noise is what I remember.
When that goal went in, I've honestly never heard a noise like it in my life. It was just ridiculous.
From that moment onwards, I don't remember that goal.
It is a little bit of a blur, but it's also not. I fell seven rows forward, completely gashed my knee, but it was all completely worth it.
The relief, the joy, the tears, it was so special. It was so special.
I've never felt from the depths of despair to such an exhilarating high so quickly.
Just to have gone through that, that commitment of year after year, season after season, of the ribbon, the disappointment, that was like the price we paid for the most amazing ticket to the most amazing experience.
Typical City again, they were against 10 men, they were just needed to beat the relegation threatened side and just could not do it the easy way.
All those things coming together, the madness of Balotelli, the genius of Aguero, the strength of Dzeko to get the equaliser, all those built up together to bring us what just seemed impossible minutes before it happened.
In the 10 years since their takeover by Sheikh Mansour, the club have scarcely been off the back pages. Three Premier League titles, three League Cups and an FA Cup has turned Typical City, the Bitter Blues, Manchester's lesser half, into a global superpower. But this transformation isn't measured by their position in the league or contents of their trophy cabinet. The citizens are on a quest for world domination. It's a balmy May evening when Manchester City entertain Yeovil Town in the Women's Super League. The Somerset side are dispatched to the tune of 5-0. But for the hosts, it's too little, too late in their bid for the title. Unlike their male counterparts, this season, MCWFC have found the title race much tougher going. But it's just a setback as they prepare for another title bid next season. For some clubs, the women's team is an often overlooked sideshow, barely filling up column inches in the matchday programme. But in this half of Manchester, they've made a concerted effort to shine more of a light on Nick Cushing's team, and via their Same City, Same Passion project, emphasise how united City are.
My name's Jane, and I am the secretary of the Manchester City Women Supporters Club. The Same City, Same Passion thing, I'm quite behind. I think it's a really good thing for the club. I think it's a good thing for women's football on the whole, kind of giving them the extra exposure. Part of the videos are, you know, it's not women's football, it's not men's football, it's just football. These are professional athletes, these women. Just because they're women footballers, it doesn't make them any less of kind of an athlete and their sport any less professional than the men's game. So kind of the more clubs that get behind it, the bigger the sport will grow, and the more Chelsea get behind it, Arsenal, other clubs who are in the league and say, no, actually, we're gonna give our women the access to the training pitches every day. We're gonna give our women the same access to the medical side of things that our men get. We're gonna give our women the same access to the nutritionists that we have working at the club already. You know, there's no reason that Premier League clubs and clubs like that can't afford to do that for their women's side.
I'm Dave. I'm a committee member of the Manchester City Women's Supporters Club. To us, like diehard fans anyway, it's always been that. City's always been City, no matter what, whether it be men, women, anything. You know, some of us are City mad and we're watching at any level. We have a number of fans, for instance, you know, that follow the girls, not only at the first team level for the girls, but at the development levels and all sorts. So the club made it an official status sort of thing, you know, the Same City. And it seems to have worked really well. I think it's a good thing for City's women, in that they're definitely getting a larger exposure. Tweets that were being viewed a couple of hundred times now are having quite a few thousand likes and things, because obviously they're on the main club's Twitter. It's 10 years now since City were taken over, and the promise was that they would treat the club as one and treat, you know, the development of players as one, no matter sir, men, women, boys, girls, it doesn't matter.
I'm Lloyd Scragg, and I'm Man City fan to start off with, and I'm one of the contributors to the 93-20 podcast. Podcast obviously mainly about Man City, 93-20, because as I'm sure most of you know, that's the time of the Aguero goal. And yeah, I also write a little column for the Sunday Observer from a City fan's perspective, and I've had a season ticket since 2002. I think City really are kind of the front runners, especially in women's football, in one, marketing it and bringing it really to the fore and putting a lot of money behind it, but also doing that in the right way, paying the girls, you know, really good wages and not kind of leaving them in, you know, in between kind of two difficult situations. And I know, for instance, that they cancelled the City Women's Instagram and their Twitter and their Facebook, and now it's everything is under the same homogenised, just at Man City on all social media platforms, which again I think is great.
Manchester City historian Dr. Gary James explains the development of the side.
I've been writing about Manchester City since the 1980s. First book came out in 1989. And in that, I included a page on the women's team. It's just really a match report. I'd been at the first Manchester City women's game, or Manchester City ladies, as it was at the time, back in November 1988. I've always felt that the women's team hasn't really been recognised for what it's achieved. When it was relaunched as Manchester City Women a couple of years ago, a lot of people in the media said that, oh, this is a new team, there's a lot of criticism, people just assumed it was the same as with the men's team, that there was no history or little history, and that the club was some sort of fabrication. It's just been established, and the truth was somewhat different. Manchester City Ladies was established in 1988. It was part of City in the Community. It was a legitimate part of Manchester City. It wasn't anything different to any other club, if you like. It was one of the first professional men's teams to adopt a women's team. And it was held up as a fantastic example of what women's football should be when it was connected with a professional club. The Women's FA quite often would push Manchester City forward as being one of the sort of role model clubs, really. After the takeover in 2008, Manchester City itself was revitalised, but then the women's team was seen as something that had to happen, had to develop, and so the relaunch occurred, and it's been onwards and upwards ever since. Manchester City, as a sort of club, as a men's team and a women's team, you know, there's the same city, same passion. So it's amazed me that City do treat the men's teams and the women's teams equally. I bought my nephew's a Top Trump set for Christmas, and in that set, going through, and then suddenly there's Tony Duggan and Steph Orton and other players alongside Aguero and company and so on, and you start to think, do you know what? This is incredible. This is a club that is giving equal focus to both the men's teams and the women's team. Obviously, men's or Premier League football is much more prominent around the world and much more prominent from a television and media point of view. But as far as the club's concerned, you walk around that stadium and you see a picture of Vincent Kompany on the outside of the stadium lifting, you know, the Premier League trophy, and alongside it is Steph Allen doing the same thing with the Women's Super League. I've been doing an oral history project with trying to capture the stories of the women from 1988 through to the current time, and I talked to quite a few of the modern players, and they're delighted with the way City treat the game. Some of those players have been to other prominent Women's Super League clubs, and they didn't get treated equally or fairly or the same, you know, not at times. What they've got at Manchester City is quite special, and I think that's coming across loud and clear. They train alongside the men in the, you know, a fantastic facility, and they get the best dietary support and well, you name it, everything.
This game takes place in the Academy Stadium, part of the Etihad campus in East Manchester, the beating heart of the Man City empire. The Academy Stadium is just across the way to its bigger sibling, Manchester City's men's stadium, the Etihad. But this smaller home is just as bright sky blue, just as ultra sleek, and at a capacity of 7,000, it would make more than a few league sides grounds feel inferior. This stadium has witnessed the success of Steph Orton and co, as well as the development of the club's crop of youth talent. Yet it's still just that stone's throw away from the stadium in which Guardiola's team strut their stuff.
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that the club embrace women, so they should. They should diversity in religion and sexuality and everything. Well, we live in a world now, you know, where, come on, you know, everybody should embrace everybody. Women's football is still a long way behind men, let's be honest about it. That's not meant to be a sexist comment. We can just deal with the facts, if you like. When City's women play, you know, it's usually about 1,000 people turn up. When the men play, it's 55,000. You know, there's a massive gulf in wages. The women are being paid almost what you'd call a normal person's salary, whereas the men are on obscene, you know, I make no bones about it, obscene salaries. So there is a huge gulf.
Here's David.
I was at the academy ground watching the women's game against Lyon in the European Cup semi-finals. We were there, and Ferran Soriano and Cheeky Begiristan and Cal Doom, the chairman, were all in that area, just mingling with the fans, photos. There is a very different feel about the club.
Manchester City's tentacles stretch far out of Eastlands and into all four corners of the globe. To the fans who watched their club relegated to the third tier of English football as recently as 1998, how does this empire building affect their relationship with their beloved club?
I've been to see New York City, Yokohama Marinos, Girona in Spain. There's a team in Colombia coming on board. And whilst I have an interest in those clubs now, and often players go out on loan there, I think what they're hoping is that as time goes along, that the new wave of City fans who come in will buy into the whole City brand. As I don't like that word, but that's what it is. I can see why you would aim for that and why that would be an ultimate destination, but they're still on that journey.
If what you're doing is transporting the values of the club and trying to create a network of clubs that can develop and share players and talent, that doesn't seem that bad. I mean, if you look at the relationship with Girona this last year, and you look at a couple of our younger players players that are on the verge potentially of developing into first team players, and how those have been sent out on loan, that just seems like a good thing. Is it a problem? I can't see it being a problem. I haven't got a New York City shirt. I haven't got a Melbourne. Do you know what I mean? I don't particularly follow any of those teams are up to. I know some people do. The model's interesting, I think. I'm not aware of any other football club that's attempted that kind of networked model. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Man City became so rich and so successful so fast that heads are still spinning. Former BBC Man City reporter, who's been to over 2,000 City games, Ian Cheeseman, and now ex-CS Manchester presenter, vlogger, podcast host, columnist and author, recalls a time when City's budget meant being frugal in every department.
You won't remember this, but older people will remember that before VHS and Betamax, there was nothing. In fact, Match of the Day only used to highlight maybe one or two games. You didn't get the comprehensive coverage you get these days. So for the club to come up with their own video was pretty revolutionary at the time. But City, being the City of then, back in the 80s, they wanted a volunteer. They couldn't afford to pay them. So I remember having a meeting at the club with a commercial person who said, and I was there in my lunch hour from my normal job, and he said, sorry, it's a bit cold in here, but we can't afford to turn the heating on during the week. And he also said to me, I bet you've not had any lunch, have you? You're in your lunch hour. And I said, yeah. And he said, we might be able to get you a cup of tea. And if I asked the chef nicely, possibly a piece of toast, will that be all right? And I'm thinking, I'm sitting here, you're trying to persuade me to work for you for free, to sit up on the gantry commentating. But I love the club that much, there was a no-brainer for me to say yes and start the adventure, if you like, with the club doing that. These days, of course, they've got City Square, where they've got presenters in there. When they have the meetings, you know, they don't do it in a cold room and just have a piece of toast and a cup of tea. So the world has changed, the club on the pitch has changed. The team that I first started watching right at the very beginning was the team that had just won the league and the FA Cup in the late 60s. There was a good spell in the 70s. This was during the period where they didn't have much money, but the team itself wasn't a bad team, with Rodney Marsh and some of the leftovers of the 68 team still in place. And then started the yo-yo years, up and down, relegations and despondency among fans. Culminating, I suppose, with the relegation to the third tier of English football. It seemed like it couldn't really get any worse then. Fortunately, it did bottom out in that season, and you probably know the story about beating Gillingham 2-0 down, going into stoppage time and turning it around, winning on penalties and starting the journey back. And then, sounds very easy, but the shake comes in, suddenly there's money to spend, club's transformed. And it is what it is today.
Having been the put-upon, not-so-noisy neighbours for so long, How does it feel to walk in United's shoes? Has everything changed that much?
It's a different club, and yet it's the same club. There are some people that were there right at the very beginning of my journey are still around, people like Bernard Holford, who's the secretary of the, or was the secretary of the club, and he's still around. I only saw him last night. There are players from that era who I know quite well now and mingle with. And there are people who've come in perhaps a bit more recently, but that are grounded from that period, so have the club at heart. But there are also a lot, an awful lot of new people who've come in who in truth probably haven't got an awful lot of interest in City, the football or the club, but are top people in their professions who now are part of this huge, huge company, worldwide brand, and are trying to make grow the club bigger and bigger and bigger year by year.
My expectations for the season are quite small, really. I have to say that I plan to go to every game at home, a few aways. I want to, you know, see us play well. Anything else is a bonus. Do you know what I mean? And that hasn't really changed from watching some right shite.
Here's Lloyd Scragg from 93-20 again.
I think United generally are a very self-entitled fan base. I hope City never become that. However, we could easily, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years, if we dominate and if we continue to be one of those big clubs across Europe, always in the last four of the Champions League, then, you know, we could be having a different conversation about kind of the ethos and culture of the club.
On Who Are You, we've covered a lot of clubs in difficult situations, on and off the pitch. But surely everything's rosy for Manchester City supporters. Both the men's and women's teams tasted relatively bitter European exits in the latter stages of the Champions League. But aside from continental success, what more do Man City fans want? Are we entering an era when not only the English game, but the world of football falls under the shadow of the blue moon?
From a City perspective, I do think, especially over the next 2-3 years, it could be an era of dominance domestically, definitely. I think Europe's a different kettle of fish. It's just so difficult to win a Champions League. I think obviously we've got a very good chance, but domestically, I can't see past City winning it for the next couple of years at least, I don't think.
The Champions League, by a lot of people, is seen as the Holy Grail, and I'm sure the owners would want that as well. I'm sitting here now as a City fan in a year when the Blues got knocked out in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, but won the league. So anybody listening to this will say, well, he would say that because of what's happened this season. My dream is to watch City win the Champions League, so I make no bones about that. However, I think that actually winning the domestic league over 38 games is a much prouder achievement. The 38 games that City have played to win this league have been magnificent.
No, I don't think it would get boring. Nobody expects that. You know, we might jokingly predict about the, you know, how we're going to win every game 9-0. I usually put a bet on about outcomes at the end of the season, and all it's bet about is winning something, even though we haven't got a cat and mouse chance. And this year, the odds are rubbish.
One thing I think people do forget about City, because they're the big name in football in terms of the men winning the Premier League a lot, is that we're still quite a young side on the women's side of things. We only became professional and rebranded in 2014, and it's only 2018 now. And in that time, we've won four trophies. You know, we've won the Continental Cup twice, we've won the league, and we've won the FA Cup. So we're not doing bad. So a lot of people saw the season just gone, yeah, we didn't win a trophy, but we pushed all the way. And we finished second. We've achieved Champions League football again, which is, I think is a must for the club, Champions League football. Long term, I think they're obviously a bit like the men, the target would be to win the Champions League. I think that is the holy grail for the club on both levels at the moment. Obviously, that would come alongside consistent, sustained success in domestic tournaments, especially like your league.
I think that the main ambition of the team is it's probably the Champions League. I mean, that's kind of the holy grail, isn't it? Obviously, from a fan's point of view, you want to win your domestic league. But I think the club's kind of longer-term view would be that they want to be good enough to... They want to be the best in the world. So the Champions League is kind of where you're looking at.
I am Caroline Sherritt. I am a member of the MCWC Supporters Club, and I am also a Manchester City Women's season card holder. I think next season we're going to be able to really, really, really push to get to that final, and we're developing with every game we play in the Champions League, and we're learning more and more about the teams in Europe. Girls had gone in for a press conference before Leon, and Pep had been in them before. He'd been asked to give advice and he said, well, we haven't got to the semi-final, so we don't. I can't really say anything. Both teams watch how the other one is doing, and I think the girls really, really root for the lads, and vice versa, the lads are keeping up with the girls, their performances, and I presume when they see them around the CFA, they're saying congratulations, good luck, whatever, before the game, after the game, and I think they're really involved with each other. I think off the pitch, just get more girls playing football, I suppose. I think they're already doing a brilliant job with that now, and I think the more it grows and the more, obviously, with the formation of the United team as well in Manchester, I think it's going to push more young girls to be playing football there.
The club maintaining its links with the local area is essential. For years, Man City fans mocked their city rivals for having a fan base from seemingly everywhere but Manchester. For now, they're reaping the benefits of the global game. But do Man City fans secretly yearn for the typical city days? Was there not something more authentic about having a direct local connection with their club?
I talk to a lot of supporters, I go to a lot of sports club branches, and as time goes along, I've warned them of this, getting tickets for cup finals, getting tickets for big games will become harder. And I've said to them, you want to be successful, you want to watch beautiful football, well, we're watching both of those things now, but that means that more and more people will want to come to our stadium, will want to watch our games. That drives the price up ultimately, and also that demand means there will be times when you might not, even though you might have watched them through all the thin times, might no longer get access to tickets. We've always, as City fans, looked at United and said, half of them come from down south. It's 76,000, but 35,000 are travelling from everywhere else except Manchester, and laughed at them and not liked it. But actually, that is the direction that City are going, and that's the direction they want to go in. But that's part of the juxtaposition of wanting to have a proper club that you identify with, a hometown club, which City are, but also wanting to be massively successful. You sort of can't have both. City at the moment are trying them very hard, I do believe that, to get it right, get that balance right, but it's very, very difficult.
Basically, a lot of what City fans have always loved about each other and kind of revelled in is that we've always been this kind of big sleeping giant where, you know, our attendances were always incredible throughout the kind of 80s and the 90s when we were, you know, not the force that we should have been. And we've always been very good at kind of taking the piss out of ourselves. And obviously we're from Manchester and the weather's crap. Obviously that kind of aspect of the club is gonna go, and it's gonna diminish when you become one of Europe's best teams. But the trade-off is, you know, instead of watching Stuart Pearce's team in 04-05 score no goals from New Year's Day to May at home, you get to watch the likes of De Bruyne and David Silva and Sergio Aguero play football for your team. So at the moment, City and the people that run the club are doing an incredibly good job to keep the fans engaged and to keep things kind of real and keep the roots. My only problem really is with the ticket prices, which continue to go up, which is baffling. But I do think, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the line, it'll be a very different conversation. And if City have been a consistent powerhouse, then inevitably things will be different. And, you know, I think we will be, unfortunately, closer to one of those kind of slightly more soulless, bigger European giants. But that is just, I think that is just the trade-off for success in a very commercial and kind of modern footballing and business environment.
I would actually say not a lot has changed between then and now. As a child, you kind of, for some reason, think, despite there being evidence against it and despite there being evidence that actually your club isn't very good, you go there and you think, oh, well, they're great and they're going to win and they're going to be this wonderful team. And I think City gradually beat that out of me over the course of 10 years between about 1997 and 2007. But I still enjoy it, and I don't think you can't enjoy the level of football that they're playing now. But I enjoyed it back then. Even then, even though things weren't great at times, you still had that kind of camaraderie and the gallows humour. There were many games where you had to go to Main Road or to later the Eastlands and make your own fun, because what was going on the pitch just wasn't fun at all. It was kind of like your rite of passage to being a football fan. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that City are any different to any other club, because, you know, you'll know better than me. You speak to fans of other clubs and they all have the tough times, they all have the good times. And yet you still feel so invested in it all, and you still do that that kind of habitual going to the games and watching it and just believing in it. And that hasn't changed. I think my outlook on the team has changed, and I'm not as, I don't think I'm as emotionally involved as I am now. I think I'm a lot better at being able to take defeats and a lot better at not getting too high after victories.
One area in which a club can maintain an authentic connection with its fan base is through developing young players to play for the first team. Manchester City's academy is the envy of the country, with huge amounts of money devoted to nurturing young talent. But when Pep Guardiola can sign the next superstar with the money behind the back of the sofa, what hope do the likes of Phil Foden and Brahim Diaz have of establishing themselves in the Man City first team? And does this matter to City fans?
As much as I probably don't like to hear it, I think it's probably it's more towards the production line side of things in terms of doing and running it like a business model, a little bit like Chelsea. Our chairman, Khaldun Al-Mubarak, who's an incredibly well-spoken and kind of erudite man, has done a couple of kind of end-of-season wrap-ups, and he didn't even get close to explicitly saying that that was the case. But I thought it was quite inferred from what he was saying. And he's always really strong on getting the youth players in and bringing them through. But I think this is the thing. It's when you are such a high-level team, you've got to be so good at 18 to even make the bench on a team that is one of the top five teams in Europe, when you're going to have people like Raheem Sterling, Sergio Aguero, Leroy Sané, Bernardo Silva, David Silva, Kevin De Bruyne. So to get in there on merit at 18, and yeah, okay, generally youth players come in when there's injuries or they get a chance in a cup game or whatever, but you know, to even be pushing that level at such a young age, I think that's something that I think we're all really hoping Phil Foden will grow into and become that player. Because we've not had a homegrown player who has kind of come in and really taken the baton at City since Nader Manua or Micah Richards. Yeah, we've had kind of players come through and flitter with the first team like Kieran Trippier, but no one who's really come through and kind of taken that mantle. And I think, yeah, the reason I am interested in the academy is I think the upside is really great. And if Foden becomes that player for us, then yeah, it'd be fantastic.
Host of the Blue Moon podcast and ESPN blogger David Mooney shared his views on the academy.
I'm not going to sit here and say that fans don't kind of connect to that and don't want that. There is a certain aura about Phil Foden as a 17-year-old lad from Stockport. I would always be a little bit cautious about this because City's track record with youth since the takeover isn't great. There's always been a name who's going to be the next big thing, and they've always ended up moving on. And in fairness to City's decision not to kind of put all their eggs in their basket, they've never really gone on and done better things. So there is the argument to say that they might have been the next best thing had City played them, but equally their track record isn't great. If they were the next best thing, somebody would have taken a chance and got it. But there is an idea that City have the best facilities for youth football, and that the attraction is not come to City, you'll have the best facilities and you'll be playing Premier League football with a team that goes on to win the championship. The appeal is come and enjoy the best facilities for 3 years and we'll get you a good deal. We'll get you a good move to a good club. I think a lot of the players that join have kind of understand that. Is that a bad thing? I don't know if it is. There's a lot of money in football and people are willing to spend it. If they've got the money, they'll quite happily flex the muscle and do it.
The development in Manchester has been remarkable. And you can't help but feel this is an ownership that have looked beyond the video game approach to long-term success. There's more to Man City than simply signing world-class players.
When the Sheikh came in, he seems to have made a particular effort to maintain City's roots. They changed the badge back to the old badge that they used to have. And everything that they've done now in terms of expanding the City group, as they call it. They've built the Connell Sixth Form College. There's some housing being built. They've redeveloped a massive area called the CFA now, which was land that had been poisoned by chemical works in the past. And although, of course, they've got an ulterior motive to a certain extent, I also believe that they believe in history and keeping a strong identity with the city. And as a Mancunian myself, I'm really pleased about that.
And Dave and Jane shared how the club were integral in the beginnings of their supporters' club.
Sarah, who's our chairperson, was contacted by the club. Well, she was instrumental in just getting a few of us together to make a bit of noise at the games. So originally, for the first season after the rebrand, they played at the old Athletic Stadium, which is over the road next to the Etihad. And in there, you know, she was there banging the drum. And, you know, the few of us that wanted to make a bit of noise tended to flock towards her. And anyway, the club noticed that. and they asked her to come in, and if she could put together a few people of different age groups to represent different ages and get together, would we be interested in forming a branch of the City Women Supporters Club, which is attached to the main City Supporters Club? So we did, and we formed a committee, which myself and Jane, if we can speak to Jane in a minute, are part of. And since then, the supporters club has gone from strength to strength to strength, with, you know, over 250 odd members, with thousands of followers on Twitter, Facebook. It's really good, and we have a, you know, we have a really good match day community going now. Everyone knows each other, and we're getting new members all the time. And we have had the backing of the club with most things as well. We've just done our Player of the Year, which was Keira Walsh, which was the supporters club Player of the Year. And we did a meeting with her last Tuesday, and she came and received our trophy.
With more success comes more intense scrutiny of the real reasons behind it. There's Kevin De Bruyne and Nikita Paris's abilities with a football, of course, but, as everyone knows, this success wouldn't have been possible without the unbelievably deep pockets of their owners. While generous in treating Manchester to their money, the story behind it is sometimes a lot more uncomfortable for City fans to hear. In previous episodes, we've heard how a club's ownership can damage a club's standing in football, but the damage here might be more to do with a club's reputation. But do the fans see it that way?
Yeah. I think the important thing to say is that you can't be 100% altruistic. You can't have... anything that I do can't really affect what happens in Abu Dhabi. I have to make peace with that. That doesn't mean to say that I'm okay with everything that goes on in Abu Dhabi. For kind of like cards on the table, I'm gay, I'm a gay fan. The treatment of gay people in Abu Dhabi isn't great. It's not something that I'm comfortable with. But equally, it's not something that I'm going to be able to change. So I either have to go, I'm going to give it up, not going to watch City and can't do anything while these guys own it. Or I go, well, it's going to exist come what may. The money that I'm giving them is minuscule. I would also claim to not be that well informed about what goes on around that. And I don't know if it's a sense of putting my head in the sand and ignoring it, or if it's more a case of just there's so much going on to be informed about that it's just not possible to be. I don't know. But again, it's a difficult relationship. And I know there are some City fans that have misgivings about what happens in Abu Dhabi, so it's not just me. But equally, you can't. I don't think you can turn around and say, well, you can't not enjoy the football because of it. Because there's so many issues surrounding it. It's not possible to. You can't fight all battles. Is ultimately what I'm getting at. And I know there are City fans that aren't comfortable with what happens with the owners. The owners have done wonderful things for Manchester and certainly East Manchester. They've invested so much money in the region. Does that excuse what goes on in Abu Dhabi? Not really. It's a really difficult question to answer, and it's one that I don't think will keep many City fans up at night. It's one that certainly doesn't keep me up at night. Maybe I'm a hypocrite, I don't know.
At least Man City's is an ownership who seem to know what they're doing with their mounds of cash. Something that's very rare at the top level of football. What's even rarer is the level of consideration these investors seem to place in the club's heritage.
People will talk about money being pumped into the club, into Manchester City, but do you know what? It doesn't matter whether it's a men's team or a women's team. What's wrong with somebody actually investing in facilities? What's wrong in people investing in academies and in the community? You know, Manchester City's owners are actually building houses. Would you rather have the owner of your football club taking the profits out of a club to fund their lifestyle or to fund their other business interests? Or would you like the owner of a football club to actually be investing to improve facilities and community activities for the people of your city? Manchester City have always had a strong community activities and community base, if you like. They've always done work with the local community, no matter what the time, no matter what the finance of a club and so on. But it's only really recent years where they've been able to sort of step that up a gear with facilities of the level that they've got. I can't see any other football club, certainly not in England, that have invested in their community in the way that City have. Back in September 2008, I got a call from Gary Cook, who was the chief executive at the time, and he said to me he'd like me to come down and meet someone. He wanted me to talk to them about the history of Manchester football, not just City, but Manchester football. turned up. Gary Cook came out to see me, and as we're walking into the boardroom at Manchester City, he told me, "I'm about to introduce you to Khaldun Al-Mubarak. He will be the new chairman of Manchester City, and he wants to ask you about the club." It turned out that that day Khaldun had seen Mark Hughes, the manager, and Jim Cassell, who was in charge of the academy, and then me. And so his first question was quite simply, how and why did the football club start? And so I went through the story of its formation and so on. And then we sort of went into details about some of the greatest heroes in the club's history. The badge, we talked about the badge right at the start, what it meant, what it symbolised. We talked about Manchester and what Manchester and City meant to Manchester. We talked about Bert Trautmann, the great goalkeeper from the 1950s. And Khaldun had obviously done his research, but what mattered was the fact that he was asking these questions, and that at no other time has any chairman ever asked, how did this football club start? How often do they ask specifically what the fans feel, who the fans care about, what who are the heroes? They don't. But here was Khaldun on his very first day in Manchester asking those questions. He also explained that people will talk about Manchester City as just buying players, and he said, inevitably we have to buy players to get the team to a certain level. But he said, longer term, it's the investment in our facilities and in our academy that will keep this club going and will develop this club. And obviously I walked away like everybody else thinking, yeah, of course, you're going to spend this money. Yeah, you're going to do that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And within a couple of years, the academy was built.
Man City are the modern football club, a sleeping giant awoken by the wealth of foreign investors, from the third tier to middling top flight club to world domination.
I'm just personally grateful that I had the chance to experience all the different stages of that. And perhaps if I'd come in now from the outside as a younger person, I might see that club as a very different club than the one I see it as. And certainly people who are not City fans would probably look at it from the outside and they'll talk about the money and, you know, the ridiculous spending that they do and the wages. And I sort of get that. But from where I've come from of watching and knowing the players who've scraped along and survived and had good humour about it all, they deserve a bit of success. And one of the characteristics that they still have is humility, humour, and long may that continue. As good as it is at the moment, it could all collapse tomorrow. Guardiola moves on, retires. I don't think for one moment that the momentum that the club have going through under the ownership is going to change. You know, people say, oh, they could walk away. They're not going to walk away. They've built a club now that's self-sustaining. 5 years from now, if you came back to me and they've got, you know, a different manager, different era of players, they might be third or fourth, they won't be 15th, but they might not be playing this type of football anymore, and we'll be looking back on this as the golden era. So, you know, enjoy it while it's here, enjoy the golden era, which is what I'm doing. Do I want it to carry on? Yeah, exactly like this for as long as possible. And you never know, one day the Sheikh might go, well, thanks very much, I've done my job now, I'm going to move on to something else. But by then, City will be so well established as a club, as a group, there'll be plenty of investors and people who want to come in and just carry it on, even if it's not one investor. But the momentum is unstoppable. I mean, certainly in my lifetime, I don't envisage now another Gillingham game in the playoff final at Wembley. I think those days are gone forever.
Whilst they may represent modern football in a way not everyone will like, they're modern in numerous positive ways too. The investment in community, in their promotion of the women's game, and their remembrance of City's past. At the heart of it all, though, they remain typically City.
On the final day of the season, all they needed to do was beat relegation-threatened Southampton to get 100 points and have that landmark, you know, 92 and a half minutes gone, and pretty much every City fan is going, well, it's just what they do, isn't it? You know, it's one of those things, they're going to finish on 98 points and that be that. And that's City's identity, and that's what makes City so identifiable to a lot of the fans, is that they're still able to put the fans through the ringer even when you can spend £300 million building a team, build a club to have the single greatest manager that is in world football at the moment, but they can still have that moment where you think they're not going to do this. They're going to mess it all up again because it's what City do. And it's, if City can find a way to muck up, they will do. And that healthy cynicism has always been there with a lot of the fans, and it'd be interesting to see how a generation without that cynicism deals with what City can ever so often throw up.
Whether Man City are ultimately successful in their quest for world domination, time will tell. But their fans are along for the ride.
There's probably never going to be anything better than this. There's probably going to be a lot worse than this. And there's probably going to be a lot of teams that never get to experience this. You can't not be thankful when that's there in front of you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Who Are You? As with previous episodes, we'd love to be heard beyond the fan base of the club we feature. And with that in mind, we'd be massively grateful if you could leave us a review on iTunes. If you have any feedback, questions, or want to suggest a club we cover in the future, you can tweet us at WhoAreYouPod or email whoareyoupodcast@gmail.com. We've actually just got a message from someone about an exciting club for next season, and we already can't wait to make that documentary. Thank you to Ant McGinley, David and Jane, Caroline Sherritt, Lloyd Scragg, David Mooney, Ian Cheeseman, and Gary James for their contributions in this episode. And thank you to Chris Brammer for his constant supply of great artwork for our podcast. This episode was a co-production by myself, Ben Cartwright, and David Cowlishaw. If you want to know who we are on social media, we're at BAJ Cartwright and at David Cowlishaw.